Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about episode 2 of readings from New Scientist magazine, the 24th of November 2018. This article is by Alison George, and it's Scientists Migrate to Antarctica, showing an Antarctic base with a whole heap of scientists outside and a little antenna, which looks as though it's been put up in the 60s. A few of the huts. It doesn't look like an Australian base by any stretch of the imagination. As the nights get longer in the Northern Hemisphere, scientists are heading to Antarctica in their thousands. It would be nice to know how many thousand. Their quarry includes meteorites, penguins, and revealing ice cores. Yeah, okay. You can imagine penguins as a quarry, but ice cores, not so much a quarry. Okay. Only about 1,000 people overwinter in Antarctica, and the population is set to quintuple for the next 6 months, so that's 5,000. As scientists make the most of the continent's summer research season, which runs from November until April. Constant daylight, sub-zero temperatures, and brutal winds await, but that isn't enough to put the travellers off. Quote, we are well kitted out, and we stay in pyramid tents, which are surprisingly cozy. Well, I suppose that's a pyramid tent would have the maximum wind resistance. Says Catherine Joy from University of Manchester, UK, who is heading south to the colleague Geoffrey Everett in search of a buried meteorite. Oh, well, that's interesting. Antarctica is very good for meteorites. Antarctica is a particularly good place to collect these rocks. Okay, sorry about that. Not only are they easy to spot here, but the ice axe is a conveyor belt that deposits them in hot spots. Meteorites from frozen continent make up two-thirds of the 35,000 space rocks collected so far, giving valuable information about the solar system. I think what they really mean there wouldn't be over 35,000 meteorites, but there'd be 35,000 bits, debris of planets, and that's when you knock a chip off Mars, a chip off, you know, well, obviously any rocky planet. So I would think the 35,000 space rocks wouldn't be 35,000 meteorites, because it would be an unimaginably large number. But very few iron-based meteorites have been found in this Antarctic bounty. These are made from the cores of destroyed small planets, so hold vital clues about how planets formed in the early solar system. Okay, well, the majority of satellites, meteorites picked up, I think, are metallic-based. Then if you've the ones knocked off, I think, look, I may be wrong, that ones knocked off from the edges of planets are, you know, the iron stripped out of them. Everett and Joy think these meteorites are missing because they get trapped below the ice surface. In January, Everett will be heading the British Antarctic Survey's field station, Sky Blue, at the southern end of Antarctica Peninsula. So that would be another reason that if there's a heavier debris, it would fall down. Oh, I don't know. To test equipment, in essence, a metal detector and a chainsaw for finding and extracting buried meteorites. Surely you want radar. Radar's a bit more. Metal detector's a bit strange. And it's really interesting, you can actually tell the composition of your metal by looking at the inductive lag. Joy is aiming to reach rarely visited regions south of the Shackleton mountain range to scope out promising places to use equipment the following season. Quote, we will be on skidoos for most of the day, exploring the ice field. Hopefully the weather will be calm, because you need good visibility to spot small meteorites and ice. You certainly definitely do, she says. This is why, I don't know, this is why high-definition cameras would be good. If their buried meteorite hypothesis is correct, it might allow them to uncover new trove of space record rocks. Quote, it's utterly exciting to be at the heart of this. we may find a new Martian or lunar sample. Says Joy, I think what they're talking about, 35,000 lunar, and you wouldn't get a heavy rock off the moon because it's all crust material. On the other side of the continent, at France, Dumont-Urville station, workers have already begun to survey the breeding success of a nearby colony, Emperor Penguins. There are only 54 breeding colonies inside of this iconic Antarctic residence, many of which are under threat from climate change. But the colony of some 4,000 breeding pairs near Dumont-Urville. So this is a two, one's meteorite and the other's penguins. You've got a picture here. McMurdo Station, Dome C, Shackleton Road. Yep. And it's hard to see. McMurdo is the US one. Higgins Base is the English one at the very top. And Australia's got some pretty hefty bases down there. Dumont-Urville seems to be doing well for now. Their chicks. Their chicks hatched in July. In some years, few survive. But this year has been a very successful one, says Christophe Barbaud of the French National Centre for Scientific Research, CNRS. One thriving colony doesn't mean all is well for emperor penguins elsewhere. Quote, you can have very different breeding success at different colonies due to different ice conditions, says Barbaud. To see how penguins are faring in the less accessible places, researchers use satellite imagery and aerial photography, including photographs of five colonies taken on helicopter flyovers by a team of the US McMurdo Station. Meanwhile, 1,200 kilometres inland, a European team is preparing to drill back in time. Oh, well, okay, that's any core, isn't it? Analysing the air bubbles trapped in ice cores extracted from the thick ice sheets that covered Antarctica has enabled us to study the climate of Earth going back hundreds of thousands of years. The measurements have been invaluable for understanding how a planet climate can change. So far, we've only gone back 800,000 years. That's a fair whack, but it's nothing in terms of... this summer, Beyond Ipica, what's E-P-I-C-A team, which I think may have been before, is making preparations to drill a core that stretches back at least 1.2 million years, so that's 50% more. The group has identified a place in the Antarctic Plateau called Little Dome C, where it thinks the ancient ice might lie. If it works, the core of this spot will enable us to study a period about 1 million years ago when, well, precisely 1.2 million years ago, when the Earth started having ice ages every 40,000 years instead of every 100,000 years. So that's the Miskolcic cycle by that janitor bloke. That's an important thing. So, now that is interesting. Every 10,000 years corresponds to us going through different things. I really think understanding what drove this shift and whether increasing carbon dioxide levels played a part will help us predict future climate responses to higher levels of greenhouse gases. I don't quite understand how that all follows. The team does not yet know if it will be given European research funds to drill this core, a huge undertaking that will probably take place in two Arctic summers' time. So why are you telling us about now? While waiting to hear, the team is drilling Little Dome C to obtain ice chips and measure isotopes within the ice to determine how old it is. Yeah, so you can tell the oxygen 18. This will be interesting if they tell us what isotopes they're looking at. This will give us information about samples at depth without waiting for the real core. This is glaciologist Alfred Wegener, Institute of the Alfred Wegener. He's the person who did continental drift. an institute in Germany who was coordinating the project. But I think Alfred Wegener was Danish. I don't quite understand how he's German, why it's a German. The team can expect harsh conditions, he says. It's -30 degrees on a warm day. So that does mean things. I'd be... Yeah, I'd be very interested to see how you could actually burn down into a core. It is really interesting, especially if you can melt the ice in front of a bomb-shaped drill, and move the warm water behind you to refreeze behind you and apply pressure for you to keep on pushing down. That would be an interesting thing to do. So, especially if you could use some sort of magnetic pump to push yourself down. Especially if you could use sort of microwave localized heating. It's going through my brain different ways that you can heat. So it's like if you melt ice, it's important to actually just have it go directly behind you. You're also interesting. Yeah. It'd be very interesting to see my head's spinning with different things you could do. It'd be really interesting if you could have a chemical which could actually enter into the ice in a way. I've just got to think how you could do it. Okay, Gene Silencing Treats Preeclampsia by Claire Wilson. So preeclampsia is kidney shut off with high blood pressure and things when you're pregnant. One of the leading risks to women and fetuses during pregnancy could be stopped in its track by the injection that targets genes in the placenta, suggests a small study in monkeys. Whoa. So the placenta is really another organ. It's a sort of a sacrificial organ you have, which basically is a parasitical organ. Preeclampsia occurs in up to 10% of pregnancies and can lead to seizures, strokes, and kidney and liver damage. When it gets severe, the only treatment is to deliver the baby, no matter how early in the pregnancy. It can mean women having to choose between their own health and their babies. Quote, it's a very scary, said Melissa Moore, the University of Massachusetts, who's developing a treatment that has had the condition herself. Oh, that's always dangerous when you've got the decision. Preeclampsia happens when the placenta isn't delivering enough nutrients and oxygen to the fetuses. To compensate, the placenta releases proteins to raise the woman's blood pressure, boosting their supply. But these proteins can push blood pressures to dangerously high levels. Well, I didn't know exactly what that is. So, surely you can actually put in more nutrients, get some way to put in more nutrients into the placenta. But you also can imagine it's a fairly hormonal logic circuit there, so that could be put out. Moore's team has come up with a highly targeted approach known as RNA silencing, which is able to treat nucleic acid, so that's the ribose nucleic acid. I'm just trying to work out how that works. Silence the RNA, or it's the RNA used as silencers. We'll find out. That may be able to treat preeclampsia with little risk of unexpected side effects for the fetus. You can well imagine that. The technique destroys short strands of RNA molecules in our cells. They are the blueprints for making proteins. Well, so RNA has got different versions. There's messenger RNA, which is the blueprint. There's transport RNA, which is the RNA which folds up and grabs the protein amino acids. And then there's rRNA, ribosomes. These are the actual manufacturings. So targets the RNA blueprint for the placenta protein known as FLT1, known to raise blood pressure in preeclampsia. Moore's team has tested the method in a mild version of preeclampsia in baboons. When the condition was induced in 9 monkeys, their placentas pumped out more FLT1. Yeah, so you can imagine preeclampsia may not be treated by blood pressure lowering, because it's going to keep on pumping up until its blood pressure goes up. It's sort of like two teams fighting away. The team injected the RNA therapy into 3 of the baboons. So how many more baboons did they have? 9, so 30%. Over the next 2 weeks, the 3 made less FLT1 and had lower blood pressure and signs of less kidney damage than the untreated animals. You get kidney damage by your high blood pressure by your kidneys. Their offspring seemed normal, but were born a little smaller than average, i.e. they weren't getting their nutrients. Moore said this could be a result of reducing blood pressure, so further studies need to find the optimal therapy dose. The Irish biotech team called Alaim had success in rats with another RNA therapy for preeclampsia, which targets a different protein involved in blood pressure. You can imagine this being a really complicated chart, that if you stopped at one, the other one would ramp up, you know, because it would work out ways to get what it wants. Alaim brought the first RNA therapy to market earlier this year, designed to combat rare hereditary form of nerve damage. Oh, so that's a completely different thing. So it's a biotech firm, and they have got another RNA therapy, which is pretty amazing. So you don't silence the DNA, you knock off the elements. So it's, the question is how you get the RNA therapy into the cell. I don't understand how that's done. Oh, well, here it goes. RNA therapy is appealing for preeclampsia because, as well as being highly targeted, the treatments don't seem to cross the placenta, making them less likely to affect the fetus. I think crossing placentas from the fetus into the mum is the major thing, but I don't know how that works. A single injection could target a particular protein for several weeks, which would be useful in developing countries where regular medical care may be difficult to achieve as a major cause of death. Preeclampsia is the major cause of death in women. What's really interesting, I can't see, would you want to inject it into the placenta? It doesn't. Oh, okay, so it's injected in the women. Well, the placenta is 50-50 woman. You know, it's got a interface seal. So yeah, I just find that hard to imagine. So the placenta is a nutrient cut over. You've got separate blood supplies. So the placenta is half woman, half baby. Half mum, half baby. Interesting article to get your mind around that one. Okay, the next article, coming on page 10. Tiny termites dig a world of their own. So they're showing this massive plane. It looks like somewhere in Australia, but it's probably not. There's termite mines everywhere. In Australia, we have these termite mines, and these are huge. They look like grazing cattle. When sun comes up, you just see these mounds from a distance, and you walk up to them, and they haven't moved for days, and they're actually big termite mines. And apparently you can put your head up to it and hear it a bit of distance, and it's cooled. Interesting thing is, in Australia, the heat is designed, they're designed around heat. So this, I don't know where this is. Tiny termites dig a world of their own, by Sam Wong. A vast part of the dry forests of northeastern Brazil has been reshaped. The world's, north, because you're in the southern hemisphere, going north is make you hotter. The area of 30,000 square kilometres Okay, so that's 10,000. And it's trying to take the square root of that one. Yep. I've just got to work out how big that is in hundreds of kilometres. 100 kilometres by 100 kilometres is 10,000 kilometres. Is it 500 kilometres by 500 kilometres? Is that right? That's a fair swag. That's a good portion of New South Wales. Oh, well, there you go. It's large in an area larger than Great Britain. It's covered by 20 million regularly spaced mounds, each about 2.5 metres tall. Okay, we'll see if you can actually... Oh, in my head, I can't work out what the density of that is, but some areas are not that dense. And 2.5 metres tall means it's known for cooling. Known as Marundus, they are made of waste earth dug out by termites to create huge networks of tunnels. Some mounds and passages are up to 40,000 years old. It'd be interesting to see how you date easily. It's a huge carbon content. You do that, but my problem there is it's from them creating tunnels. In all, the termites have excavated more than 10 cubic kilometres of earth, making this the biggest... okay, I was just doing the maths, whether that's right. Making this the biggest engineering project by any creature besides humans, says Stephen Martin of the University of Suffolk, UK. Despite the extent of the mounds, they have been little studied until now. That changed when Martin came across them while researching honeybees in the Brazilian state of Bahia. North, east... Oh, yeah, that's the... I just really hurts my head because it's north. If it was west, it would be east. It should be the Amazon. I looked on Google Earth and realised they're everywhere in the area, but I could find nothing about them online, he says. It would be nice if they gave us a Google Earth QR code so we could see what they're talking about. The piles of earth are very conspicuous in areas where plants have been cleared, but most of them are covered by Caatinga forests, made up of small thorny trees that shed their leaves seasonally. These leaves are the only known food for termites, but they fall once a year at most, and then quickly disappear. Well, I have a few questions there. That means when the trees are cleared, what are the termites eating? I don't quite understand that. So let's read that one again. Perhaps to clear the plants and not the trees, I don't quite understand. The sporadic food supply may explain the vast network of tunnels. They allow the termites to get the food quickly. It's as if all the supermarkets were open for one day a year. The person with the fastest car would get the most food. That's a beautiful story. Saman, you need a network of roads to get the supermarket as quickly as you can because you're in open competition with your other colonies. That makes sense. I think David Attenborough did an infrared picture of this. To estimate the age of the mounds, Martin and his colleagues turned to a technique called optically stimulated luminescence. Oh, that's right. They use that for China, for pottery, to see when pottery is made. This can be applied to quartz crystals in the soil to determine when they were last exposed to sunlight. From this, conservative estimates of the ages of the mound range from 390 to 3,820 years old. The remarkable persistence is thanks in part to the dry, stable climate, with little rainfall to erode them. In addition, the soil is hard, acidic, and lacks nutrients, so the area hasn't been farmed. That's a bad combination of stuff. Oh. Bit like the Blue Mountains, a really bad land. Martin thinks the regular pattern of mounds is a result of each colony having to dig vast interconnected networks of tunnels to find food. The spacing of the mounds minimizes the energy cost of removing soil from the tunnels. The termites might use pheromones to help them find their way to the nearest waste mine. Most termite colonies, the queen after mating builds herself a chamber where she grows to a huge enormous size and produces huge quantities of eggs. Martin and his team were unable to find one of these royal chambers, so the structure of colonies as well as their size remains unknown. So they're not in the mounds. I bet he would have knocked one over. It's also unclear how the termites sustain themselves when the food supply is only available for such a short period of time. We don't know any termite species that hibernate. Maybe they do. It's interesting that I think ants effectively hibernate. All ants effectively hibernate. So when the temperature drops down too low, they absolutely freeze. So there's I remember in college once there was a line of ants, and then I opened the door, to do some sweeping, and the ant colony just froze and went cold, just stopped working when the cold air came in. Neutron star smash supports Einstein again. No matter what tests we throw at Albert Einstein's theory of gravity, it won't break. I just think we are introducing areas like black dark matter to explain it. The collisions of stars has now shown he's right again. The general theory of relativity predicts there are four dimensions, three space-time, and one of time, I think 11 dimensions is what he came up at the end. And both gravity and light exist in these. Well, in space. Not in the dimensions, but in the space defined by these dimensions. But some people argue there may be extra dimensions. They think that gravity, but not light, could occupy them. To test the idea, a team of more than 1,000 researchers looked at the aftermath of neutron stars smashing together. The collision of these stars is so cataclysmic that it causes a ripple in space-time known as gravitational waves. Perhaps I wouldn't have put it that way myself. The team detected such an event during both using both light wave and gravitational waves. They believe the gravitational waves traveled in more dimensions than light. The strength of gravitational waves should be reduced in comparison to light by the time it reached Earth. But the two measurements matched perfectly. So the light and gravitational waves were the same strength. Although it isn't definite proof of extra dimensions don't exist, it's another hint that Einstein was right. Oh, gee, that's deeply confusing. The team also measured how long the neutron stars took to spiral towards each other and how the gravitational waves stretched us through space. These two came out in favour of general relativity. There is one potential spoiler. No, it's not going to be the new scientist. There's someone who doesn't agree with... Oh, yes, it is. All of the tests included the data from LIGO, the gravitational wave detector in the US. However, some physicists questioned its decay. It has detected any gravitational waves. Because general relativity isn't comparable to quantum mechanics, you betcha. Suspicion is that Einstein's theory will have to break. Every time we get a new result that is again perfectly consistent with general relativity, I'm secretly surprised, says the team member, Michaelis Agatho at the University of Cambridge. And it's by Leah Crane. Bit of a confused article, if you come by. You've got to really explain quantum mechanics in my view. Like quantum mechanics is the God theory. The theory that's just so perfect. So expansive. I love it. Flat Rock, Michigan. That's obviously a car production place. It would be so American. It would be ultimately American. By Leah Crane, again, exoskeletons for making Mustangs. Again, why do people like cars? I don't understand myself. When a few workers at Ford's assembly plant in Flat Rock, Michigan started wearing exoskeletons for the first time, people made fun of them. Calls of, hey, Iron Man, rang across the factory line. Oh my god. I can imagine it's, I get a picture of Lego, you know, Lego movie. Putting one on, I understand the comments. I feel I look a bit like a superhero. Okay. Inside the assembly plant, it's like inside a clock of full of moving parts that all work together. Clouds wind their way through the huge building and their tires at eye level, and the workers stand beneath them attaching bits of plastic and screwing in bolts. Well, that's what they do, but I think Mustang's not a high-volume car anyway. As workers are reaching up a lot, they're prone to shoulder injuries. This is the most common medical problem for those working in the Ford factory, says Marty Smets, the company's head of manufacturing ergonomics. ESCOVESC, a wearable support system designed by Ford, it's a Ford machine, okay, and the California-based exoskeleton firm ESCOBionics, that's why it's called an ESCOVESC, is designed to prevent these problems. It uses compressed springs to support the arms when they're overhead, diverting weight into larger muscles lower down the body. Okay. So you still have to provide, so if you lift up 10 kilograms, that 10 kilograms goes down, but it's like a support, like an insect you're doing there. It doesn't actually take the weight, it doesn't make it lighter. So you imagine that it would have to balance so the weight goes to the lower back, or whatever it is. For about $6,000 a piece, the vests are much less expensive than treatment for shoulder injuries, which can run into tens of thousands of dollars, and also be bloody painful, if you ask me, because each factory tends to make more than one type of car. A plant like Flat Rock puts together both Mustangs and Lincoln Intercontinentals. A lot of tasks involved require human judgment and expertise. I would have to say they're both bespoke cars. The workers can't simply be replaced with the robots, to Smith. The vest is an expensive thing. Wearing the ESCO vest feels halfway between carrying a huge backpack and putting on a climbing harness. There are lots of straps, thick support straps around the hips, chest buckle, a forearm sleeve, and a biceps cuff with two magnetic buckles. All of this serves to hold up the device that looks like a folded bicycle. With bars connecting the arms supporting the major support, the whole thing weighs about 4 kilograms. That's actually not too bad. Which is, tells you, you know, you've got to lift that weight, it's got to help you. At the shoulder is a compressed spring that allows and powers the whole suit. So, this is a torsion spring? I don't understand. Pull a small strap on and the spring releases, making it feel like raising my arms. It's easier than keeping them at my sides. It wasn't immediately comfortable. I could reach my back pockets. I couldn't reach my back pockets or scratch my shoulder, for example. But it got easier as I moved around. Within a few minutes, I was resting my arms at shoulder level, like a child sidled up to the kitchen counter. Quote, it's like breaking in a new pair of work boots, says Bruce Watkins, who was once one of the first workers to try the ESCOVESC in 2017 and now wears it almost every day. Quote, when I first tried it on, I felt awkward, but now it's like having an extension of me. Good old you. What's your name? Bruce. Good on you, Bruce. Moving around the line, he looked completely natural in his exoskeleton. Nature, you can imagine, true, genuine wellness, let's go, and now it looks great, natural. It's easy to see how physical strenuous the work would be without it. The suit provides 2 to 7 kilograms of lift assistance per arm, or hopefully you get the same amount each time. That may not feel like much, and I was initially disappointed that I could let me pick up a car. Of course, it wouldn't, because the force goes through your legs. But some workers on the line lift tools above their heads thousands of times a day. If Watkins does 6,000 arm lifts, Quote, that's saving him more than 20 Mustangs worth of weight a day. Well, they must be putting a fair number of Mustangs through, isn't it? There haven't yet been any long-term studies about whether the suit lowers injury rates, so it's not yet clear how effective it is. But the feedback from the workers has been positive. Before I started wearing it, I was always really sore at the end of each day. This is Watkins. Now it's nothing.
This is Bruce Watkins.
Another early Esco Vest adopter, Nick Gotts, says on shifts that can be nearly 11 hours long, it makes a big difference, especially in the last hour. He wishes there were versions of his legs too, but then where do you put the force there? Spencer and his team are working on developing and testing other types of exoskeletons to assist jobs elsewhere in the production line, like those where the workers have to bend over most of the day, reaching to attach parts inside the car. The field is advancing fast, says Smith. Quote, this is what they look like now. Who knows what they'll look like in 2 years, end quote. My experience at the Ford hints at what the future of the factories may be like. Robots will surely take over many tasks, but for those still in need of human eye, technology can help enhance the performance with exoskeletons being part of it. Jobs for superheroes are safe, at least for now. That's nice, because that's a major thing about, what's it, the Incredibles. China's advanced stone tool age, so I don't know, but this is an article by Colin Barris. I do know, I do know that the stone tools were a couple of million years old, and the genius point was when one rock, many tools. Most people could imagine only one tool in a rock, and so obviously if you make 10 tools out of a single rock, that's a bit better. It sounds a small innovation, but I think Homo sapiens and Neanderthals were the first. That may be a million years old, beyond, or maybe, it wouldn't be a million years old, say a few hundred thousand years old. But before that, rocks are pretty boring. Let's see what China's advanced. And looking at this, these are look like multi-flaked tools. Ah, and you know what? Here, they've got these tools showing in back and front together. But it looks as though they've got double the amount of tools. And you can see, so looking here, you've got sometimes three pictures of a tool, of a rock. Or, there's pictures here, but sometimes it's actually four pictures. A top view, a flat view, side view, other back view going through. You're looking here, you can see the pictures 5 centimeters. So it looks as though it's a best producer, but really it's the same picture of the tool from different angles. A hall of ancient stone tools has plugged a big gap in China's archaeological record, challenging our understanding of how our species spread around the world. Our hominid predecessors began making stone tools more than 3 million years ago. Okay, that's about right. As time went on, these tools became more complex. About 300,000 years ago, a new style of tool using levalloise techniques began to appear in Africa and Western Eurasia. So that's around China. Rather than chipping flakes off the stone to create a tool, levalloise techniques worked on the stone so that the flakes themselves became tools. Now this enables several tools to be made of into a single stone tool. Now the important thing is that you can only chipping off in different directions. You can't have a crystal, you can't have sandstone. You need a glass tool. So you need rocks which are a naturally occurring glass, and then you can shatter these in different directions. Until recently, it seemed that Levalloise revolution didn't spread to places like China until much later, about 40,000 years ago, so 300,000 years. Bio Li of the University of Wollongong Australia, and his colleagues have just confirmed Leo Vostal stone tools from Granny Yindong caves near China between 160,000 and 170,000 years old. Okay. The finding follows an announcement at the start of the year that Levana stone tools, some as old as 385,000 years old, were found at a site at Quadrup in India. Okay, there you go. So that 385,000 years is obviously longer than 300 years old, so India might be the place. Clearly hominids in central, and you must admit that these are not, these are Homo erectus, these are non-humans making these tools, so get that in your little, your lunch socket. Yeah, so from those ones, they're not Homo sapiens making them. Clearly hominids in central and east Eurasia began making Levis tools much earlier than we thought, but who were these ancient toolmakers? It is a difficult question to answer, says Michael Pettit and Max Planck Institute for Science and Human History in Germany, who wasn't involved in the study. No human fossils have been found at either site. So, it's aliens. Okay. Which is sort of strange. That makes me strange. Yeah. In Africa, Levalois tools are associated with our species, Homo sapiens, while in Europe, it was Neanderthals who made them. Here you go. Perica says either species could, in principle, have moved east to China. Well, that makes the out of Africa thing a bit contentious if it was 16,000 years ago. Yeah, sorry, 160,000 years ago. They could have moved east to China taking Levalois tools with them. But it's also possible that ancient humans already living in East Eurasia, for example, the Denisovans, about whom we know very little, invented the tools independently. And that's an obvious thing. If it were our species, though, we'd need to rethink whether Homo sapiens arrived from China. Recent finds has pushed back China's records of Homo sapiens to about 120,000 years ago, but it's still 50,000 years after the tool at Grandolan site. There's no way. It's almost irresponsible to say it was the Denisovans. Liz says archaeologists urgently need to find more human fossils in China, ideally some preserved well enough to yield ancient DNA. Well, wouldn't that be fantastic? That would be absolutely fantastic. You'd need to have fossilized DNA 150,000 years old from a humanoid fossils. Good luck to you. I think that's rather unlikely. And why it's urgent, I don't quite understand. Okay. Alice Klein writes, a new company sequences your DNA for free. So they have to sell it. What is it? A service offered for free, you are the product. A firm co-founded by pioneering harvest geneticist George Church wants to let people learn about the genetic code for free. The blockchain secure device about time will be sequence people's genomes without charging a fee and will offer rewards to those who let third parties access their data. It's this awful thing. I think we should put a break on this. Now, people are already get their DNA sequenced by companies such as Helix and 23andMe, typically for around $200. If the user consents, their results can be sold to third parties such as pharmaceutical firms, but users don't receive any reward or compensation for this. Nebula Genomics has launched last week and to connect consumer interested in exploring their genetics with the research is looking for large DNA data sets to assist with drug development. The services offers to sequence your entire genome for free and keep it secure. You can then choose to share genomic data anonymously with companies our research institutes in return for nebula credits. Oh dear. People who receive credits for sharing other information, such as whether they have diabetes or arthritis. Oh, okay, get this credits. Okay, so you got the basic credits, and then you get more credits if you say, and my DNA, I've got a thing. This should help researchers identify patterns between certain gene variants and diseases, such as company called Farner Dennis Grishin. Well, I suppose the most obvious thing is genetically identify people who are prone to sign up and people who won't sign up. That would be really good. Users can access services on Nebula platform using their credits. For example, someone could buy information about their risk of developing Alzheimer's disease based on their genetic disease risk. I suppose that's good because it's asynchronous, isn't it? For the time being, people won't be able to convert their credits into money. Pharmaceutical companies are currently prepared to pay up to $1,000 for individual donors, but Nebula hasn't decided whether to allow such cash transactions, says Grishin. Jason Savard of Deakin University Australia warns that some drug companies may use people's genetic data in ways that they aren't aware of and can't foresee. 100%. Look, 100%. Like, no one's foreseen the pain that Facebook's created. Quote, people should be free to do what they want with their genomic data, she says, but they need to be given clear information about how it will be used so that they can make the right decisions. Church's other ambitions, including bringing back the woolly mammoth and editing the genes to fix diseases to reverse. Oh, God, what? What a bore. I want to bring back the woolly mammoth. Right, I'd like to bring back the ethical human, last seen in the 1950s. Your computer's clock can give away your way online, by Edgent. A website tool can track your internet activity even if you use standard ways to hide your browsing habits. Tracking people on the internet is normally done using cookies, tiny files left on other computers by websites we visit. These are used for security purposes, such as for detecting suspicious online banking logins, and also by advertisers to target people based on their online visits. But these tracking cookies have become increasingly ineffective because many people use tools such as blockers, which keep them at bay. Now, Icelander's Schnaz Waller at the University of Deusto in Spain and colleagues have developed a tracking tool that doesn't need to use cookies. Instead, it relies on detecting tunneling variations in the computer's hardware. The tool works by measuring subtle but unique differences in the way quartz crystals in the computer clock behaves compared to crystals in other computers. These differences affect how quickly the websites are processed by a computer, so they act as a digital fingerprint for a device. When 300 volunteers made a one-off visit to a website using the tool, it could uniquely fingerprint around half of them. They combined with other techniques that measure how a computer processes the website's graphics, 80% of the devices can be identified. Quote, our technique is far more reliable and practical than any existing fingerprint technique. That is actually rather interesting. So, it's how often it asks for it. So it could be server side. I don't know. I don't know if you knew this was up, you'd scramble it. Quite unfortunately, modern computers are too diverse, and there are too many ways that diversity can be noticed and used by trackers, said Peter Eske of the Electronics Vendors Frontier, a privacy rights group. That means privacy tools must improve to stay ahead of detection techniques, he says, which is my fundamental thing, I would say. Phantom Galaxy, our new neighbour, Chelsea White. Phantom Galaxy. Given the amount of data we have about galaxies, I find this hard to believe. Let's see what they have to say. Looking behind the disk, dust of the Milky Way, a nearby ghost galaxy that we haven't noticed before. It looks like no other galactic structure we've seen, according to astronomers who found it. Although not everyone agrees. So, basically, our galaxy is quite dirty, and if you actually, one place you can't see into deep space is actually through Sagittarius A, the galactic core. There's just too much rubbish in the way. Okay. The newly detected dwarf galaxy is a third the size of the Milky Way, so it's almost not a dwarf galaxy. It is in the Antilla constellation. Okay, I think that's only visible from the Northern Hemisphere. And has been named Antilla 2 or Ant 2. While it emits about the same total light as other galaxies near the Milky Way, it's 10 times the size of them. So the brightness is spread over a bigger area in the sky. So 10 times the size of them, so it could be 1,000 times. It depends on how it's going. It says Gabriel Tabella at the Academia Sinica in Taiwan. This makes it much fainter and harder to see. Tobia and his team found Ant-2 using data from the Galileo satellite, which tracks the position and movement of nearby stars to map the galaxy and its surrounding. They found that four bright stars of the same type, known as RR Lie variables, were moving together. Okay, that's right. And so they would have their distance encoded in their brightness, their period variables. They measured the light coming from 100 red giant stars around the four bright stars and found they, too, were moving at the same rate, which means they're part of the same galaxy. Okay, I'll go into that. But these stars also reveal that the galaxy they live is very odd. Based on the star's distance from the Earth, the team calculated that Ant-2 is enormous, spanning about 9,500 light years. Okay, so our galaxy is 100,000 light years across, so that's actually not big. Let me work that one out. That's actually not too big. So, 100,000 light years side to side, 30,000 light years in our bulge, and 5,000 light years where we're at. So it's five. So it's ours is 100,000 light years. So 95,000 light years is. It's ridiculous. That's not very big. It's extremely dim and something for something that big. In fact, it's 100 times more diffuse than members of the usual class of galaxies that astronomers have labelled ultra-diffuse galaxies. This means Antar is the lowest surface brightness of any stellar system we've seen. Totally suggests that one explanation might be the dark matter in Antar is distributed in an unusually diffuse way. But before we can know for sure how unusual Ant-2 is, there are questions to answer. So, 95,000 light years is not all that. 9,500 light years is not all that big. It's more. I don't understand this. I'm really confused. But before we can know for sure. Okay. Potentially a significant problem because she studies RR Lay stars observed by the Galileo satellite. She says there is an error formula in Tobias' team used to calculate the distance to Ant-2. Now, guys, the formulas are not that complicated. Oh, dear. So you can get the brightness period, read it across a line, say it's a ray, say thing and just measure off the distance. So I don't, the formula is not that complicated. That's a potentially significant problem because galaxy is extremely old. Odd traits are only that strange as the galaxy is far from us as Dover's team calculated. The big entire thing is that you watch your brightness, you're seeing it attenuated through the dust of the galaxy. I just find it's hard to believe. Kuhn says that she alerted his team to this, and they have agreed to redo the analysis. They have discovered something, but at this stage, I couldn't tell bet on any property of the system unless they confirm the calculation, she says. Torlibra says that from initial assessment, the error in the distance formula puts the R8 galaxies about 260,000 light years away. I don't understand what the fuss is. Instead of the original 424,000 light years. But he says the confirmed distance of the rest of the stars and that too with the other two methods and the distance to those stars is secure. This is rubbish. This is bizarre. A galaxy like Antu should hold hundreds of these Lie variable stars, he says. So it might be that a group of four stars his team looked at happened to be the closest ones to us. The new calculation doesn't change the bizarre nature of A2, he adds. Quote, it would need to be twice as close for the usual aspects of this galaxy to look less unusual. Changing it by 10 to 20% would still be far, and this class would be very bizarre objects, says Alan Collins, University of Victoria, Canada. I just think this is an area beset with problems. Thanks a lot for listening. I'll get these out. Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.